Lord be with you. Back in 2009, Pixar Animation Studios released a movie called Up. Pretty simple name. It's a movie about an old man named Carl, and he goes on a whole bunch of adventures in South America. There's a house that flies away on a whole bunch of balloons. There's a talking dog. There's an evil villain. And there's a precocious little boy who becomes his sidekick. But before we get to any of that adventure story, though, the movie makers set the stage with a now famously adorable and moving montage of the life of Carl before he ever goes on his adventure to South America. With a masterful bit of filmmaking, we see Carl and his wife, Ellie, as they grow up together and get married. And they live in a dilapidated old house, and they work on it, and they restore it together. Carl sells balloons at the zoo, and Ellie works at the South America Pavilion. They don't have a lot of money, but they're happy together. And we see the passage of time and the styles of the decade played out as Ellie snugs up and straightens Carl's tie each morning. In a few short minutes of movie-making magic, we experience the radiance of young love, the beauty of lifelong relationship. We see times of sorrow and times of joy. We see unkept promises, and we see goodbyes. This short clip transforms Carl's character in our eyes. He is no longer that overused and tired trope of a grumpy old man. Carl and Ellie's montage, in animated form no less, shows us the span of a human life. A life of love and meaning, work and struggle, beauty and grief. It's a glimpse of the universal desire for love and companionship. It's beautiful and it's heartbreaking all at once. I challenge you to watch it and not shed a tear or two. Up pulls us with these beautiful and simple themes because they are the themes that make up our lives. We desire these things. We live these moments. We know the joys and sorrows of this sort of life because they're ours too. In a lot of ways, it's not really fair then that the lectionary starts us reading in Isaiah chapter 40. Isaiah 40 is a big payoff, the part of the story where the message changes for the better. We've skipped right over a really big rough patch of scripture. This massive work of the book of Isaiah starts with a deep dive. Chapters 1 to 39 are the voice of the prophet with big chunks of the sort of thing that made prophets unpopular in a lot of ways, unwelcome voices. This is a call for the prophet to preach judgment. And there's no mincing words here. This is a wave of nauseating horrors and appalling atrocities, great humiliation, suffering, and sorrow, like an unthinkable series of news headlines. Foreign armies as agents of God's judgment, a people devastated. Chapters 1 to 39 are the predictor of the kingdom of Judah going into exile. Captives in the hands of the Babylonians. And so, in the space between chapter 39 and 40, we might well be served with a sort of movie montage of our own. Selected clips with a chilling soundtrack compressing over 100 years of tragic history into a few short movie moments. And we could see those terrible judgments come to pass. People humiliated, displaced, families torn apart, subject to the whims and the desires of the current dominant power. Except we really don't need to see that, do we? Because we've lived generation and generation of this reality. There's been a montage of grief and horrors playing in the background set on a radio or a television set of our cozy lives for as long as we've been here. A far-off war or a near one. A new migration of refugees. Another despot or tyrant or malignant leader. More broken promises from throne rooms and press briefings. Deeply flawed systems, bigger than you, bigger than me, bigger than all of us put together. The whole of creation even groans with us in this display of grief. So maybe that's why the lectionary fast forwards us past all of this, landing us in the place where these harrowing accounts finally give way, into the poetic meditations of Isaiah 40. And here again, the prophets are called to preach. But this time, in 587 BCE, it's not judgment they proclaim. This is a message of comfort, life, hope, salvation for people in distress, healing words for a traumatized and scattered remnant on the verge of despair. These are words of hope, yes, but they are clear-eyed and honest about the world we live in. This isn't saccharine, sweet Christmas cheer. This isn't a hasty papering over of reality. This is Advent. Advent is a time of waiting and watching. It's a time of hoping and dreaming. It's a time of frustration and unrest, a time to name the troubles in our lives, our private, secret, little troubles, our personal relationship and life struggles. And it's a time to shake our fists at the big broken systems in the world. This is Advent, and together we worship. We worship this same God, the Creator who keeps telling us that everything is going to be all right. This God who makes such outrageous promises. He will feed his flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs in his arms, carry them in his bosom, and gently lead the mother sheep. Advent is a time where we can join our voices and say, any time now. That sounds great. Now might actually be a good time, God. Thank you very much. Comfort, oh comfort, my people, sounds plenty good to me. And yet, until that day comes, when the Lord comes in might and his arm rules for him and his reward is with him and his recompense before him, we remain ever clear-eyed people, Advent people, discontented, frustrated, waiting in deadly serious hope, praying for peace. Not unlike, actually, pretty similar in a lot of ways to those people that lived their life all those many years in Babylonian exile, generation after generation. Thankfully, at present, we are not captives in a foreign land. And against many odds, here we live in what's known as the developed world, the recipients of so many creature comforts. But we are no less susceptible to the fear and doubt and despair that plagues our race. We seem so little in the face of such terrible forces, relentless pressures. And even in this troubled state, we are not alone. Here in Isaiah 40, the voice of the prophets speak for us. In response to the call to prepare the way of the Lord, a voice says, what shall I cry? All the people are grass in their consistency, like flowers of the field. The grass withers, the flower fades, and the breath of the Lord blows upon it. In the scope of history, in the face of nations and armies on geologic time, we humans are so little. We're here for such a brief time, like grass and flowers. Here, Isaiah 40 echoes Psalm 90, which we read earlier this fall. We grow and we bloom, little creatures on a little crack and a rock in space, waiting for a disaster or a heart attack, or maybe just for our sun to go nova. Seeing ourselves in this way, as grass and flowers, the frailty and the littleness and the all-too-briefness of human existence, the strangeness of what it is to be biological creatures with this little lifespan that our Creator has given us, eking out these short little lives, pressed in by time, dragged down by gravity. Is this frail hopeness or frail littleness a cause for hope, a source of deep meaning and purpose? Or is it a reason to live in fear or apathy? Are we desperately alone? Or are we profoundly connected? The way we answer these questions really does make all the difference, because it shapes the way we live in the days that we've been given. I don't know what your plans are for the next life, and honestly, I don't really think it matters. I want to know what you're going to do with the here and the now. So how do Advent people, grass and flowers, each of us, how do we answer these questions? When I was thinking about this, a song came to mind. In the 1960s, with the veneer of post-war, aw shucks, optimism wearing thin, there was good reason to doubt the taken for granted institutions and systems which our society had previously used to give us meaning and purpose and hem us in. And American folk music spoke to a growing desire for justice in the face of commerce and the military-industrial complex. And people were sure that we were on the verge of a great revolution. Some of you were there for it. The hippie dream of peace and love. And in 1966, Malvina Reynolds sang a song called God Bless the Grass. I don't know if you've noticed, we made a cute little bookmark for you. Maybe you want to put it in the book or stick it on your fridge. It's got the lyrics. Does anyone know this song, choir? Do you know this song? Yeah? Anybody want to come sing it right now? Just belt it out? Nobody? Come on, somebody's brave enough to sing. I don't want a copyright violation by playing a YouTube video off my phone. No? Evelyn wants to sing it? Oh, me. Yeah. All right, I'll try singing it. Actually, I don't know if I want to do this. She sings in such a high, reedy register, but let's just see. Here we go. God bless the grass that grows through the crack. They roll the concrete over it and try to keep it back. The concrete gets tired of what it has to do. It breaks and it buckles, but the grass grows through. And God bless the grass. Whew, that was worse than the whole sermon, but okay, anyways. What a great song, right? Speaking to the struggle of the little and the pliable against the overwhelming hardness of concrete and stone. I don't think Malvina Reynolds was being a hopeless optimist either when she wrote this song. The forces of empire are overwhelming and terrible. Sometimes they're mundane and they're numbing and anesthetic, mowing right over people, reducing the richness of human experience to statistics, easy cliches, sales figures, and collateral damage. We, the church, are called to resist these forces. And thank God, we don't identify with the concrete. There might have been a time when we did, but we sure don't now in 2017. And the church is not a lawn. It's not the pretty turf on a golf course. We're not an orderly flower garden. We are the scraggly tufts and persistent blooms that resist the heavy weight of tyranny and oppression in all its subtle and unsubtle varieties. Finding purchase in little unplanned spaces, making homes in the hard places, tentative and fragile, bearing the beauty of creation and shaping the landscape. A few weeks back, referencing Jeremiah 29, Ryan called this a bloom where you're exiled message. We struggle and we bloom now where we are because the promise of the one who made us. Despite setbacks, despite troubles, despite the overwhelming forces of history that spray on us like Roundup, we remain people waiting in hope. Hope that seems absolutely preposterous. In just a little span of time, we too will return to the earth like grass and flowers. But for the time we have, we grow in the cracks we find ourselves in. And through all of it, the word of our God will stand forever. This is the one we wait for, the ancient one, the creator of galaxies and the maker of dandelions, the one who promises to arrive in power and gentleness. And even as we wait, shaped by this same hope, can we speak words of comfort? Do we live lives of blessed purpose? Are we prophets in a troubled age? In these Advent weeks, weeks of meditation and pondering, weeks of orientation and remembering, may these same outrageous promises made by a living God open our hearts, shape our lives, lift our heads, nourish us and grow us and stretch out our roots and our leaves and our blossoms. And God bless the grass.